begin the prepared portion of tonight's program by taking a look at a section of a book that has recently been released. There is a fair amount of publicity, a fair amount of exposure for the career of Malcolm X, the black American Islamic leader, due to the movie Malcolm X, of course, by Spike Lee. And coincident with the release of the movie was also the release of the best single information source to date on Malcolm X's assassination. That book is entitled The Judas Factor, subtitled The Plot to Kill Malcolm X. It is authored by Carl Evanz, E-V-A-N-Z-Z, a journalist whose work has appeared in the Washington Post, among other publications. The book has been published in hardcover by the Sheridan Square Press and copyrighted in 1993. To make a very long story very short, this particular book deals with the role of the U.S. intelligence community in the assassination of Malcolm X, something that I will be downloading into an archive show in months to come. It has already been the subject of one lecture that I've given in Southern California, and I will be lecturing in other places about that as well, notably Los Altos Hills and Foothill College on February 27th of 1993, an observation of Black History Month. The book, to make, again, a long story short, deals with not only the intelligence community's role in the assassination of Malcolm X, both from a strategic standpoint, what the intelligence community hoped to achieve, and from a tactical slash operational standpoint, how the intelligence community went about doing it. But specifically, the book relates the assassination of Malcolm X and the assassination of Martin Luther King, as well as the deaths of a number of other black American leaders of various types and statures, to the operations in the United States of the U.S. intelligence community. And among the things that are discussed in the Judas Factor is the use by elements of the American far right and the intelligence community of the Nation of Islam, the so-called black Muslims, of which Malcolm X was a member and with which Malcolm X broke very sharply. We're going to be, again, discussing that in weeks to come. One of the more interesting connections that was unearthed by Carl Evanz during the course of his research was an operational link between the Hunt family of Texas, specifically ultra-right-wing American oil billionaire H.L. Hunt, an individual whose family has been involved in a number of ultra-right-wing activities in the United States over a period of time. And the Hunt family's name crops up in a number of different ways in connection with the investigation into the assassination of John Kennedy. We took a look at that in a big, big way in, among other programs, Radio Free America 37. And interestingly enough, H.L. Hunt was among the financial backers of the Nation of Islam. And the discovery of this was among the many things that alienated Malcolm X from the Nation of Islam, popularly known as the Black Muslims. In this particular book, there's a discussion of H.L. Hunt's funding of the Nation of Islam. I'm going to talk more about that in a second, but let's read for a minute from The Judas Factor by Carl Evanz. Of H.L. Hunt and his financial support for the Black Muslims, or the Nation of Islam, and its leader Elijah Muhammad, with whom Malcolm X had a sharp break. Malcolm had at one point been the leading spokesperson for the Nation of Islam, and he had been very close to Elijah Muhammad. He broke sharply with both the man and the organization. Elements of that organization figured in the intelligence community's ultimately mortal response to Malcolm X's activities. Of Malcolm X and his discovery of the relationship between the Nation of Islam and one of its main financial backers, H.L. Hunt, Carl Evanz writes as follows. Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X said, had been depositing contributions from his followers in a secret bank account in Switzerland, and his wife had been doing the same in accounts she held in Beirut and Cairo. Although the Nation of Islam received hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations each year, Malcolm X said, the accounting books he examined in the messenger's office revealed that the Nation of Islam was spending far more cash than followers were contributing. By the way, I would note that among the major focal points of Carl Evanz's work is the fact that an individual who for a long period of time was the treasurer of the Nation of Islam, a fellow named John Ali, last name A-L-I, was in fact a long-time and highly placed FBI informant within the Nation of Islam. Continuing with Carl Evanz's account, when Bradley and Jamal, those were two associates of Malcolm X, When Bradley and Jamal inquired how this was possible, Malcolm X's reply hit them like a bombshell. Quote, "There is a Texas millionaire who supports not only Elijah Muhammad, but the Minutemen and the John Birch Society," Malcolm X said. "His name is H.L. Hunt. I think he is in oil. Have you ever heard of him?" Unquote. Bradley had, but Jamal had not. Harrelson Lafayette Hunt wasn't just a millionaire. He was a very racist, very right-wing spendthrift who was worth nearly $500 million in 1960. According to a lawsuit filed against him, he once sold food that was, quote, "unfit for human consumption," knowing that such sales would end up in Negro and low-income areas, unquote. Hunt regarded African Americans as a threat to Caucasian control of American politics, as he made clear in numerous radio broadcasts and interviews. During a radio broadcast in mid-1960, Hunt exposed his abhorrence of African Americans, quote, "We are now in an area where whites, however free from racial prejudice, will be forced into the Republican Party by the Negro population, which will help control the National Democratic Party and undoubtedly share or preempt many local offices," unquote. So great was his fear of black political power that within days of Kennedy's November 3rd defeat of Nixon, Hunt contacted the Republican National Committee to request that it study why the, quote, "rural vote," unquote, went to Kennedy. Alfred Zoll, Z-O-L-L, and by the way, I suspect very strongly that this is a misprint. I suspect this is Alan Zoll. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Alfred Zoll, one of Hunt's chief ideological allies, had since 1936, advocated sending all African Americans back to Africa. Last sentence again. Alfred, parentheses, I bet this is actually Alan Zoll, a prominent American fascist of this period. Alfred Zoll, one of Hunt's chief ideological allies, had, since 1936, advocated sending all African Americans back to Africa. Hence, it's not really surprising that he would be interested in financing the Nation of Islam. On October 28, 1960, Hunt, who opposed then-Senator John F. Kennedy's presidential bid because Kennedy was Catholic, admitted to mailing 102,000 copies of an anti-Kennedy leaflet in an effort to win the Democratic nomination for Texas Senator Lyndon B. Johnson. A few days later, he announced that he would support Kennedy's race for the presidency against Vice President Richard M. Nixon. Hunt's decision was unusual given his hatred of Catholics and the fact that he had financed Nixon's bid to gain the vice presidency in 1952 on the Eisenhower ticket. In early 1963, Hunt's commercial corporations were linked to the anti-Semitic Liberty Lobby and the John Birch Society. On November 18, 1963, one of Hunt's sons, Nelson Bunker Hunt, donated money which was used for a rancid anti-Kennedy ad that John Birch Society supporters wanted to run in the Dallas Morning News on November 21st, the day before President Kennedy was scheduled to arrive in Dallas. By the way, interrupting, that son was Nelson Bunker Hunt, a member of, among other organizations, the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, a German-based intelligence network involving numerous Third Reich alumni, many of whom were either involved with or loosely affiliated with the Galen Spy Organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that jumped to the CIA at the end of World War II, and elements of which figured in a prominent operational way in the assassination of John Kennedy. Continuing with this particular section, and of course, but before I do, recall that in Radio Free America 37, which I'm going to be adding to, we took a look at the Conservatism USA organization, which was based in the Dallas area, and that had been founded by Larry Schmidt, an individual with strong links to Ruby Oswald and the Hunt family, and whose organization figures at the operational level in the events surrounding the assassination of John Kennedy, if not the actual event itself. Continuing with Iman's account, on November 21st, the day the ad ran, a mafia member from Chicago named Jack Ruby went to H.L. Hunt's office, as did other characters whom history would link with the event that occurred at 12:30 the next day. At 12:23 on November 22nd, H.L. Hunt watched as Kennedy, the man he hated, drove in a motorcade through Dealey Plaza. Minutes later, President Kennedy was dead, and Hunt was on his way to a month-long stay in a Mexican hideaway. 3 days later, Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the man accused of assassinating President Kennedy, and who, for unexplained reasons, had a personnel file at CIA headquarters in Langley. Again, at first glance, the notion that an organization like the Nation of Islam might be financed by an individual like H.L. Hunt would appear to be altogether bizarre. However, as Carl Evans has noted here, the association of black separatists and black nationalists with their ideological opposites, racists and fascists, that is not as bizarre a notion as it might appear to be at first. As indicated in Evans' account, H.L. Hunt, like many American fascists and racists, has advocated sending all African Americans back to Africa. This also has a very strong historical analogy with the first go-round of fascism, so to speak. One of the things that I covered in a miscellaneous archive show entitled Fascist-Zionist Connections was a fascist, an explicitly fascist branch of the Zionist movement known as the Beit Harim. The Beit Harim, founded by a fellow named Vladimir Jabotinsky, last name J-A-B-O-T-I-N-S-K-Y, was, as I indicated, an explicitly fascist branch of the Zionist movement, and the most famous graduate of the Beit Harim, so to speak, was Menachem Begin, the recently deceased Menachem Begin, who, of course, went on to become premier or prime minister of Israel. The Beit Harim, for a period of time, found cause, as did other elements of the Zionist movement, with the Third Reich, before the by now very well known final solution to the Jewish problem, the Holocaust, the Nazi extermination of European Jewry. The Third Reich, and the SS in particular, had hit upon what, for our purposes here, might be termed the not-so-final solution to the Jewish problem, namely the elimination of Jews in Europe, not through physical extermination, but through coaxed, perhaps we should say, emigration. The Zionist community, prior to World War II, in a number of places, particularly in Germany, actively sought to bolster the Jewish population of what was then Palestine, a British colony, by promoting emigration to Palestine by various members of the international Jewish community. After Hitler's succession to power in Germany, and of course the Third Reich had as one of its ideological cornerstones a doctrinaire anti-Semitism, the Zionist community in Europe in general and Germany in particular did, for a period of time, form an operational alliance with Amt 4B of the Reichssicherheitshauptamt. The RSHA, Reichssicherheitshauptamt, was literally the High Bureau of Reich Security that was composed of the SIPO, the Sicherheitspolizei, or Security Police, composed of the Kriminalpolizei, the regular police, and the Geheime Staatspolizei, or Gestapo, the secret state police. The other main branch of the RSHA was the Sicherheitsdienst, or SD, the SS Intelligence Service, one branch of which, Amt 4B, was in charge with so-called Jewish problems, ultimately the extermination of as many Jews as they could get their hands on. However, before the final solution to the Jewish problem was hit upon in the Wannsee Conference, the policy of Amt 4B, particularly in the pre-World War II period, was focusing on making Europe, quote, Judenrein, or Jew-free, by promoting Jewish emigration to Palestine. In this capacity, an operational, albeit grudging, relationship was formed between elements of the Zionist community and the SS. The Zionists wanted Jewish emigration to Israel to bolster the Jewish population in Palestine. The Germans wanted to do it simply to get Jews out of Europe in general and Germany in particular. Eventually, of course, the policies of Amt 4B and the Third Reich hardened to the point where they undertook the extermination of Jews. But I think one can see, although by no means a perfect analogy, nonetheless a valid analogy between what the explicitly anti-Semitic Nazis did in Germany and what the explicitly racist neo-Nazis and fascists in the United States have been attempting to do with regard to their relationship to the Nation of Islam. In Radio Free America number 13, dealing with the Aryan Nations umbrella neo-Nazi network and dealing in general with the evolution of American fascism, we took a look at the cozy relationship between the current head of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, and American Nazis and fascists such as Robert Miles, a Michigan Ku Klux Klan leader, and Tom Metzger, also a former KKK leader and currently the head of a racist organization in California called White Aryan Resistance. The ostensibly strange bedfellows, Farrakhan and people like Robert Miles and Tom Metzger, doctrinaire racists, represent something of a continuation of the relationship between George Lincoln Rockwell, the Führer of the American Nazi Party, and Elijah Muhammad of the Nation of Islam, Rockwell was a supporter of Elijah Muhammad's, spoke highly of him, and just as H.L. Hunt, who hated black people and thought they represented a threat to Caucasian society, did, George Lincoln Rockwell found common cause with the Nation of Islam because he also sought the return of all blacks in America to Africa in order to make America Schwarzenrein, one might say, black free. So although it would appear to be a very strange relationship at first, in fact, with an intelligent study of history and with an intelligent study of the history of fascism in particular, the strange political bedfellows made by watching Farrakhan and people like Robert Miles and Metzger go to bed, and also with watching people like H.L. Hunt or George Lincoln Rockwell lie down, so to speak, with Elijah Muhammad, these things are not as strange as they might appear to be on the first go-round. I would also note that in this particular book, Carly Bonds cites elements infiltrated into the Nation of Islam as well as elements of the Nation of Islam itself as in all probability having been utilized by the intelligence community in the operational assassination of Malcolm X and elsewhere as well. H.L. Hunt, as indicated in that passage and as we have looked at in numerous archive shows, H.L. Hunt, in addition to his links to the American far right, had through those links to elements of our national security establishment, and the H.L. Hunt funding of the Nation of Islam would no doubt have facilitated the use of elements of that organization in an operational capacity by elements of the intelligence community. I would also note, and we're going to be taking a look at the interesting functioning of Louis X, as he was then known, now known as Louis Farrakhan, in relation to the assassination of Malcolm X. I would also note that Louis Farrakhan is currently one of the icons of the fascist third position. That is a branch of the international fascist movement, which specifically aims at attracting people of a more progressive political background to fascism by embracing certain aspects of the progressive political agenda. The heroes of the fascist third position are interesting. In addition to Louis Farrakhan, they are the Ayatollah Khomeini, Adolf Hitler, Chairman Mao, and Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. As we will see later on in this program, both Khomeini and Gaddafi, individuals who are ostensibly bitter enemies of the United States, in fact have received active support from elements of our national security establishment, in particular that faction of the U.S. intelligence community grouped around, among others, George Bush, Theodore Shockley, Thomas Kleins, Edwin Wilson, Frank Turple, some of the people that we have looked at in so many archive shows in the past as having been actively involved with promoting some of the very terrorists and terrorist organizations we are told we need to defend ourselves against. We will get into that later on in the program. I would note in this regard that there is an archive show, a two-part archive show available, called The Fascist Third Position, done in 1988. But again, Farrakhan, in addition to Khomeini and Farrakhan, are two of the heroes of the fascist third position. We're going to be taking a look at, by the way, before I go on to that, I also want to remind you of the archive show dealing with fascist and Zionist connections and the Beit Hanoui movement in particular. In addition, by the way, to Menachem Begin, another graduate of the fascist element of the Zionist movement, is Yitzhak Shamir, who for a time was a member of the Stern Gang, an even more right-wing element of the Zionist community. For a time, the Stern Gang actually advocated a military alliance between the Zionist movement and Nazi Germany in order to drive the British out of Palestine. I would note that the Beit Harim, the fascist Zionists, actually took military training at Mussolini's Naval Cadet School in Italy, and in an article written for L'Idea Zionistica, the Italian Zionist magazine, the leader of the Beit Harim, Vladimir Yabotinsky, indicated that this was more than just a marriage of convenience. There actually was ideological solidarity between the Beit Harim and Mussolini's fascisti. I would note also that for a time, the SS-Zionist alliance produced the odd situation of having the leader of the Haganah, the Zionist self-defense organization, a Polish Jew named Fivel Polkisch, actually working directly with Adolf Eichmann and Otto von Bolsving, two of the SS leaders of Amt 4B, both individuals who later were to figure prominently in the Nazi extermination of the Jews, and also two individuals who, in the post-World War II period, worked at various times for the Galen Organization when that was part of the CIA. I would note, too, that the fascist Zionists, the more reactionary branch of the Zionist community for a time, was actually engaging in pitched battles, particularly during the World War II period, in the streets with socialist Zionists. Unfortunately, in retrospect, an awful lot of important history becomes obscured. Among others, Albert Einstein cited the rise of the Beit Harim in post-World War II Palestine/Israel as being a threatening consideration. And in retrospect, it is not difficult to see that the right-wing and reactionary elements of the Zionist movement gained far more power in the post-World War II period within the Zionist movement than they had in the pre-World War II period. Again, I refer people to that particular archive show, Fascist and Zionist Connections. It's also very interesting to find some operational links between elements of the Zionist community and some of the very Third Reich elements that also figure prominently in the generation of some of the very Palestinian terrorists who have been among the most implacable enemies of Israel, and who later on, in the post-World War II period, some of whom at least became Mossad agents, wittingly or otherwise. We're going to be touching on that later on in the program this evening. The next portion of tonight's program is an addendum to Radio Free America program number 37. That is a massive archive show that I did in late 1992. I began it on July 26th of that year and wound it up on October 18th. And a chilling but very important addendum to that archive show was carried in an article that was featured in a publication called Extra. Extra is the monthly magazine put out by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and the December 1992 issue of Extra contains an article by Martin Lee. Martin Lee is a researcher, investigative reporter, and an individual whose work has featured in a number of different archive shows on this program in the past. I've utilized Marty Lee's work in Radio Free America program number 21 and Radio Free America 28 and Radio Free America number 32 as well. Now, in the December 1992 issue of Extra, again put out by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a liberal media watchdog group based in New York, there's an article entitled Neo-Nazi Violence, U.S. News Media Fiddle While Germany Burns. This article deals primarily with the American media's soft peddling of the return of fascism to Germany. Return here belongs in quotes, because as we looked at in a big, big way in Radio Free America 37, under the pressures of the Cold War, in fact, Nazism was never removed from Germany. This is not to say that all Germans are Nazis by any means, or that all institutions in Germany are Nazified, but rather to indicate that the roots of Nazism were never pulled in post-World War II Germany, and because of their extreme anti-communist credentials, the Third Reich alumni were put back in power in virtually every major facet of German life, as well as the German government proper. Again, we haven't got time this evening to discuss that in detail, but I refer people in a big, big way to Radio Free America 37, which explored this at length and in detail. I'm going to read this entire article into the record as an addendum to Radio Free America 37. Many of the references here might appear to be glib or cute. I apologize in advance, but again, with the original archive show itself having been 3 months in length, there's no way realistically that I can provide all of the requisite background material to clarify all of the points that will be touched on in this article. Nonetheless, it's an important one, and it is going into the archives as what I suspect is by no means the last addendum to Radio Free America 37. Again, this article is from Extra, the issue of December 1992. It is headlined, Neo-Nazi Violence, U.S. News Media Fiddle While Germany Burns by Martin A. Lee, and it begins as follows. In a scene starkly reminiscent of the Hitler era, 800 neo-Nazis stormed a refugee center in the Baltic seaport of Rostock, Germany in late August, terrorizing gypsies and Vietnamese guest workers with Molotov cocktails, shotguns, and bricks. As the housing complex went up in flames, local residents cheered and sang, Deutschland über alles, unquote. Shortly after the violence ended, German officials caved in completely to the Nazi mob by moving all refugees from Rostock to other locales that are off limits to the press. Washington Post, September 26, 1992. Rather than diffusing tensions, the government's decision sparked a wave of terror unlike anything Germany has witnessed since Adolf Hitler was in power. Nazi thugs went on a rampage assaulting foreigners and anti-fascists in over 100 cities and towns during the next 2 weeks. Stern, of September 3, 1992, Germany's largest news magazine, underscored how serious the situation had become. Quote, Germany faces a political catastrophe. The rule of law has capitulated before the terror. Events at Rostock have shown that the German security forces have neither the capacity nor the will to protect innocent people from the terror troops of the radical right. Unquote. I would jump in to interject that this is by no means the first time that has happened. As we shall see, one of the aspects of American media coverage of the rise of neo-Nazi violence or the return of Nazi violence to Germany, one of the aspects of U.S. media coverage has been to ignore the very firm indications that this is more than just a bunch of drunken punks on a rampage, that in fact this violence is well organized, premeditated, and that it enjoys the support of many of the most powerful elements in Germany. Beyond that, as Martin Lee points out, and as I pointed out in Radio Free America 37, the response of the German government to this neo-Nazi violence has been to initiate legislation which would limit foreign immigration into Germany and to begin returning, among others, gypsies to Romania, where they face oppression. That is an oddly, well, perhaps not oddly, but that is an ominous echo of the events of the World War II period, when in addition to the Jews, gypsies and other so-called racial undesirables were mercilessly liquidated by the Third Reich. And again, the policies of the Kohl government have basically been to agree with and to cave into the neo-Nazi violence, although there have been some demonstrations against neo-Nazi violence, and some organizations and sub-publications have been belatedly banned. In fact, the response of officialdom in Germany to the return of Nazi violence to the streets of that country has been less than vigorous, and in fact, official disclaimers to the contrary notwithstanding, the authorities in Germany, or significant elements of both the political and the law enforcement as well as military establishments in Germany, appear to be relatively sympathetic to what is going on. Continuing with Marty Lee's article, with few exceptions, this sense of urgency, that referring to the Stern article of September 3rd of 1992, with few exceptions, this sense of urgency has not been communicated by U.S. news media. A combination of factors, selective reporting, adherence to official agendas, lingering Cold War biases among journalists, and intimidation by the German government, has skewed press coverage of the neo-Nazi revival that is spearheading Germany's rapid goose step to the right. Reflecting the spin preferred by Chancellor Helmut Kohl's ruling Christian Democratic Union, or CDU, numerous U.S. news accounts stressed the public relations dimension, with German leaders bemoaning the damage done to their country's image and business prospects abroad. Interrupting again, it should be noted that the return of Nazi violence to Germany has actually had an impact in Germany by limiting, or on Germany, by limiting, at least to a certain extent, foreign investment. A number of potential foreign investors have grown leery as a result of the recent activities in Germany. In the opinion of this observer, that has much to do with the belated move by the Kohl government to at least contain, if not eliminate, what is going on. I would not place a lot of stock in the sincerity and the depth of the sentiments of the CDU and Helmut Kohl's government with regard to their professed anti-fascism. Recall, among the things we've looked at in the past is a book that was suppressed in Germany, which maintains that Helmut Kohl himself was served in the Waffen-SS during the closing days of World War II while a teenager, and that in that capacity he actually helped some of the top Third Reich leaders escape the onrushing Soviet armies. Returning to Martin Lee's article, comparatively few reports focused on the plight of the victims of racist attacks. No foreigners or refugee advocates, for example, were quoted by Stephen Kinzer in his New York Times article of September 16, 1992, on the light sentences given to two neo-Nazis who killed an Angolan guest worker. The Times' Ferdinand Protzmann, P-R-O-T-Z-M-A-N, did some exceptional reporting that portrayed events from the victim's point of view, for example, 826-92. In a section called Cold War Finger-Pointing, Martin Lee writes as follows in this article. Following the lead of the German government, many reporters were quick to frame the violence as primarily an, quote, Eastern problem, unquote. A Houston Chronicle editorial of September 4, 1992, condemned the Rostock pogrom, calling it, quote, a particularly poisonous flower of the former communist regime, unquote. According to Mark Fritz of Associated Press, October 10th of 1992, most neo-Nazi attacks occurred in former East Germany, where communism's demise brought economic collapse and left a population consumed by pessimism and bereft of democratic values, unquote. Ignoring reports to the contrary from their own correspondents in Germany, a Washington Post editorial of October 5, 1992 asserted that, quote, the violence is concentrated mostly in the former East Germany, unquote. Ditto for Tom Gelten, G-J-E-L-T-E-N, on NPR's morning edition of 827-92, quote, there have been something like 700 attacks this year alone, according to the federal government. A disproportionate number of those have been in East Germany, unquote. Gelten was wrong on both counts. In addition to underestimating the number of neo-Nazi attacks, he and other journalists erred in parroting German officials who claimed that most of the violence occurred on former communist turf. In fact, West Germany has experienced many more neo-Nazi attacks against non-Germans and desecrations of Jewish cemeteries than the East. Los Angeles Times correspondent Tamara Jones was one of the few U.S. journalists who cited statistics released by the Verfassungsschutz, Germany's FBI, which indicated that 1,296 incidents of neo-Nazi violence during the first 9 months of this year, and of these, two-thirds took place in the West. By the way, Verfassungsschutz is V-E-R-F-A-S-S-U-N-G-S-H-U-T-Z, actually Verfassungsschutz. Continuing, Craig Whitney conveyed a misleading impression in the New York Times of October 14, 1992, quote, right-wing and neo-Nazi parties have benefited from a protest vote in local elections, particularly in the formerly communist eastern part of the country over the past 2 years, unquote. While the fascist Republikaner Party and other extremists have gained seats in several western states, far-right parties have not fared nearly as well in the east. A September 1992 survey by INFAS, I-N-F-A-S, a German research institute, showed that 19% of West Germans would vote for the Republikaners and other extreme right parties. The figure for East Germany was 12%. Again, note that American journalists have basically followed the lead of the German government proper and are downplaying the number and significance of the neo-Nazi attacks and are incorrectly attributing these to be occurring mostly in the eastern part of Germany. That is not the case. And again, whatever the sins of the former East German government may have been, and I hold no brief for that or any of the other Soviet bloc governments, it is a remarkable stretch of political imagination to attribute what is going on in Germany today to the former East German government. Recall that something like 75% of all of the people in Germany are in the former West Germany, not the former East Germany, excuse me. Also recall that in Radio Free America number 37, in addition to detailing the reinstitution of Nazis in the supposedly new Germany, I pointed out that, as cited by German anti-fascist researcher and journalist T.H. Tettens, the German press itself, those elements which were willing to deal honestly with the question of Nazism, had done a much better job of reporting to the German people concerning the return of Nazism to Germany than the American press had done with the American people. It became essential as a function of Cold War journalistic politics to represent the quote, new, unquote, Germany as a bastion of democratic instincts and activities, and the former East Germany as being what it was, accurately, basically a Stalinist clone. And, in fact, whatever the sins, as I said, of the former East Germany may have been, the fact of the matter is that West Germany was anything but democratic. There were many democratic institutions in the former West Germany, but as I've indicated and as I documented at great length in Radio Free America 37, as we touched on in Radio Free America 2, and as we saw again last spring in a miscellaneous archive show called The New Germany and the Old Nazis, the, quote, democratic, unquote, West Germany was in fact a breeding ground and a hiding place for precisely the elements that had brought the Third Reich to the situation that it eventually achieved. The next section of Marty Lee's article deals with another aspect of misinformation in the American press, and this attributes the neo-Nazi violence in Germany to the activities of former Stasi agents, the Stasi being the secret police of the former East Germany. Marty Lee writes, in keeping with the efforts of Kohl's CDU to scapegoat East German communism, Stephen Kinzer, K-I-N-Z-E-R, wrote in the New York Times of September 13, 1992, quote, besides neo-Nazis, there are other obvious groups to blame. The Rostock police disclosed that former agents of the Stasi, the dreaded East German secret police, unquote, were among those arrested during the Rostock riots. Kinzer gave undeserved credence to the allegations by omitting pertinent details about the so-called agents who turned out to be three ex-Stasi snitches in their early 20s. The German federal police subsequently dismissed the Stasi connection as bogus. Nevertheless, a number of news outlets played up the Stasi angle. Chicago Tribune, September 4th of 1992, Atlanta Journal-Constitution of that same day, and the Associated Press of September 2nd of that year. Continuing, other reports suggested no organized force was behind the wave of violent attacks, asserting that the anti-immigrant feeling, quote, is particularly strong in eastern Germany, unquote. CNN correspondent Ken Yautz, J-A-U-T-Z, declared on August 26th of 1992, quote, it is not organized. The unrest began in Rostock quite spontaneously and unexpectedly, unquote. This contradicted numerous European press reports, Daily Telegraph 8/26/92, Agence France-Presse 8/25/1992, that described neo-Nazi leaders at Rostock speaking with each other via car phone and walkie-talkies, while broadcasting commands to convoys of followers from various West German cities who converged on the Baltic seaport at the same time. According to the Searchlight of October of 1992, the London-based anti-fascist monthly, neo-Nazi leaders met and planned the Rostock attack weeks in advance. Tipped off by anonymous phone calls and publicly circulated leaflets threatening violence, Rostock city official Wolfgang Richter, R-I-C-H-T-E-R, warned the German Interior Ministry that a neo-Nazi attack was imminent, but no preventive measures were ordered. Now note here that an official of that city, Rostock, Wolfgang Richter, warned the German Interior Ministry that a neo-Nazi attack was coming. And again, note that that ministry reacted indifferently to the information. We're going to take a look at a key official of that Interior Ministry and his Nazi credentials in just a minute. Continuing. Except for the Los Angeles Times of August 28th of 1992, no major U.S. news media mentioned evidence that German officials ignored signs of an impending attack. Beyond ignoring signs of an impending attack, there are disturbing indications that elements of German officialdom were certainly supportive of, if not actively condoning, this type of violence, the type that has beset Germany in the past months. The next section of Martin Lee's article is called Police Racism. The subtitle of the article indicates the basic substance of this section. It reads, for 2 hours, the local police and fire departments turned a deaf ear to desperate pleas from four German TV journalists and 115 foreigners who were trapped inside a Rostock guest hostel that had been firebombed by neo-Nazis. Despite a pattern of lassitude and negligence on the part of German law enforcement authorities, major U.S. media often portrayed the police as, quote, beleaguered, unquote, quote, overwhelmed, unquote, and, quote, outnumbered, unquote. Perhaps I should have said bewitched, bothered, and bewildered, but instead it was beleaguered, overwhelmed, and outnumbered. Continuing. Racism was never explicitly cited as a factor in the, quote, inability, unquote, of the police to stop attacks against refugees. U.S. journalists failed to cite a survey showing that support for the aims of fascist Republikaner Party is particularly high among police in Bavaria, 50%, and Hesse, 40%, two West German states. U.S. news media have also not reported instances when German police, in the eastern city of Eisenhüttenstadt, for example, assaulted foreigners with batons and billy clubs after the Nazis had already left the steam. By the way, Eisenhüttenstadt is E-I-S-E-N-H-U-E-T-T-E-N-S-T-A-D-T. A few weeks before the Rostock pogrom, police attacked three refugee centers near Dresden, where neo-Nazis have been allowed to parade openly in the streets, while law enforcement authorities pretended not to notice the illegal Sieg Heil salutes and the illegal Hitler salutes and shouts of Sieg Heil. This last sentence again. A few weeks before the Rostock pogrom, police, now this is not neo-Nazis, police attacked three refugee centers near Dresden, where neo-Nazis have been allowed to parade openly in the streets while law enforcement authorities pretended not to notice the illegal Hitler salutes and shouts of Sieg Heil. On the weekend of September 5th and 6th, while ultra-rightists attacked in 47 German cities and towns, a neo-Nazi march in Kelheim, K-E-L-H-E-I-M, was given heavy police protection, Searchlight 1092. Police complicity with German neo-Nazis was examined in a Swedish TV documentary, The Truth Makes You Free, which aired this year in numerous European countries, but not in the U.S. Journalists occasionally cite examples of judicial leniency proffered to Nazi hooligans and murderers, such as the light verdict handed down to two skinheads who beat an African immigrant to death while police stood nearby and did nothing, or the suspended sentences given to 10 German rightists who burned down a hostel for asylum seekers. But U.S. news outlets rarely juxtapose these reports with the stern treatment of anti-fascist protesters, including well-known Nazi hunters Serge and Beata Klarsfeld, who were roughed up and arrested along with 44 other French Jews on October 19th after they unfurled a banner in Rostock. Last sentence again, but U.S. news outlets rarely juxtapose these reports with the stern treatment of anti-fascist protesters, including well-known Nazi hunters Serge and Beata Klarsfeld, who were roughed up and arrested along with 44 other French Jews on October 19th after they unfurled a banner in Rostock. Except for USA Today, no major U.S. newspaper outlet bothered to report, no major U.S. news outlet bothered to report that the Klarsfelds had been arrested and detained overnight, while other Jewish protesters were imprisoned for 9 days before they were released. This is in marked contrast to routine police procedures whereby hundreds of violent Nazi youths are freed after being held only a few hours. Again, this is chillingly reminiscent of the treatment given to many of the anti-fascist activists in Weimar Germany, many of whom were dealt with more harshly by the authorities than were the Nazis who were committing most of the violence in Weimar Germany. And in an even more chilling echo of the activities that preceded the rise of Hitler, apparently in some cases, the German authorities, not all, in addition to downplaying the significance of the German attacks, in addition to ignoring indications that police and other elements of officialdom were complicit in this violence, the German government has at times even cracked down on the journalists who were reporting on the Nazi violence in Germany and the return of fascism to that country. And again, the fascism there never really left. In a sidebar to this particular article, Martin Lee writes, and this sidebar is entitled, German government ignores Nazis, cracks down on journalists. The sidebar reads, a disturbing and underreported aspect of Germany's rightward lurch has been the government's harassment of journalists who have covered neo-Nazi violence. Shortly after they escaped from a Rostock guest hotel that had been firebombed by neo-Nazis, four TV journalists from the ZDF network became the target of a criminal investigation by German authorities who alleged that the reporters had, quote, staged, unquote, the riot to get sensational film footage. The German government backed down after international protests from human rights and journalism organizations, including FAIR. On other occasions, German officials have charged journalists with instigating neo-Nazi activity, alleging that they paid right-wing militants to shout Nazi slogans and make stiff-armed salutes for the cameras. In early November, Margrethe Fahr, F-A-H-R, a Berlin-based freelance journalist who reports on far-right activities, was charged with, quote, using the symbols of organization which defy the Constitution, unquote. It seems that a German secret police unit intercepted a fax from Fahr about German right-wing extremists that included a reproduction of an illegal Nazi SS symbol. Under German law, Fahr, who was Jewish, could be sent to prison for this so-called offense. The harassment of this journalist comes at a time when uniformed Nazis wearing SS insignia parade openly with police protection on the streets of major German cities. This last sentence again. The harassment of this journalist comes at a time when uniformed Nazis wearing SS insignia parade openly with police protection on the streets of major German cities.